Once again, we're looking at low-dose aspirin.
Looking for heart disease in people that have sudden death.
When physicians get together, do they make better decisions?
And does preventing amyloid prevent Alzheimer's?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on April 12th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn first to JAMA Network Open because I found this study to be so amazingly novel. An issue that we have never talked about in 15 years of podcasting. I find that almost astonishing. This was a look at what I served up as, if physicians get together, do they make better decisions? So there's a study that's called the Human Diagnosis Project, or Human DX, which is a multi-country data set of differential diagnoses by individual physicians, trainees, and medical students, and they all get together all of this data. So they've been doing this from May 2014 to October 2016, and they took groups of 2 to 9 randomly selected physicians, and they said, hey, let's solve an individual case. And what are they looking for? Diagnostic accuracy, as assessed by correct diagnosis in the top 3 ranked diagnoses for an individual. What did they find? They had over 2,000 users solving over 1,500 cases. And what they found was that this collective intelligence approach was associated with higher diagnostic accuracy compared with an individual's decision, including individuals whose expertise was in the same area as the case diagnosis. And they found that there's kind of a sweet spot with regard to that collective diagnosis making.
I think most of us would agree that 2 heads are better than 1, and that when you're trying to arrive at some sort of a diagnosis, collectively, people can do it better than a single individual. So on the one hand, these results aren't terribly surprising, but the way they did this was a little unusual. They didn't have 2 or 3 learners or physicians sitting in the same room solving a problem. They took a look at a number of different individuals that had answered 1,500 different cases trying to arrive at a diagnosis, and they determined if you took 2 or 3 of those together, they were more likely to arrive at it. It is interesting, but it really doesn't mimic what happens in real life. How do you make this happen? Whereas you don't want a patient sitting around with 3 physicians around a table contemplating what's going on. That's really not very practical. And the other issue is, did this collective wisdom actually improve the outcome of the patient? This particular study, because it used database problems, really doesn't address that. But I still think it's a very interesting study, and I'm glad you picked it.
I think that there is a way to operationalize this. And I'm thinking specifically with regard to the great growth of telemedicine and other kinds of online and electronic means of communication where we might be able to engage more than one physician when it comes to something that looks questionable.
You're certainly right. Now we're entering a stage where we're looking at team-based approaches to caring for patients, and that team collectively provides to the diagnosis and the treatment of the patient. However, having a single patient with 2 or 3 people sitting around telemonitors trying to figure out what's going on really isn't very practical. The problems that the physicians were faced with weren't bread and butter medicine. There were more esoteric things. And by the way, most of the people studied were actually residents, not attending physicians. So I agree with you, a team-based approach is probably best. Unfortunately, this study doesn't address how we apply these to practical medicine.
And I would just add to that I agree, operationalizing it is certainly an issue. But I would also say that I think this is a little bit of a wake-up call to physicians that, gosh, even when you think you know, even in your area of expertise where you think you know what the problem is, it often is going to prove helpful to consult with someone else.
Absolutely. And patients know this because that's why they seek second opinions when they're uncertain about whether the physician made the correct diagnosis in the first place.
Okay. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, where you've got 2 of them to choose from.
Let's talk about looking for heart disease in people that have experienced sudden death. And I picked this particular article because we know that when people have sudden cardiac death, that is, they have a shockable rhythm and they're brought back to life or they're resuscitated, if their EKG clearly shows they're having an acute heart attack or acute MI, then it's recommended those patients go immediately to coronary angiography to see if there's a vessel that's occluded or whether the patient needs to be taken to bypass surgery. But a large number of individuals don't have evidence of an acute MI after experiencing sudden death. And the question is, should those people go immediately to the cardiac cath lab to have an angiography, or should they wait to see if they recover neurologically? And that's what this study did. They took 552 patients that had cardiac arrest, no evidence of an acute MI on their immediate EKG after resuscitation, and they subjected them to immediate coronary angiography within 2 hours or angiography that was delayed until after the neurologic recovery. And the outcome was, how did the patients do? What was their survival at 90 days? And what they found is that in both groups, about 2/3 of the patients survived, and there was no benefit of immediate angiography versus delayed angiography after neurologic recovery.
And from your seat in the bleachers with regard to clinical management, what does this say to you?
One of the things that happens when someone has sudden death and it looks like they have a neurologic injury is we subject them to hypothermia to try to preserve brain function. And anything that delays that makes neurologic recovery less likely. And we know that if you do coronary angiography in this particular study, it delayed hypothermia treatment by about 3/4 of an hour. So knowing that immediate angiography doesn't provide any benefit, doesn't need to be done, means that we can administer therapies we know that are beneficial in a more timely fashion.
That is good. So it would be your surmise that this is going to change clinical practice.
It certainly will for individuals that have no evidence of an acute heart attack on their post-resuscitation EKG. Now, those that do have acute MI need to have immediate or urgent coronary angiography. But those that don't, it's of no benefit.
Speaking of no benefit, or is there benefit, let's return to JAMA Network Open. This was a look at, I said, oh, we're talking about aspirin again. But in this case, it was the use of low-dose aspirin as chemo prevention with the risk of lung cancer. And it turns out that this idea of aspirin use for chemo prevention is a pretty big one in the cancer world, which I was not that aware of. In this case, they took a look at a big database from the Korean National Health Information Database, 2002 to 2015. They looked at low-dose aspirin use between January 2002 to December 2010, and they also looked at lung cancer diagnoses. They had over 63,000 participants, mean age of 66 years, a little bit over that, who had a diagnosis of lung cancer. They looked at the intersection of that with the low-dose aspirin use, and they basically found that low-dose aspirin use for more than 5 years was associated with a decreased risk of lung cancer, especially among elderly participants and among those who did not have diabetes. However, it wasn't earth-shattering. It was very modest. So they say, with all of the known risks of aspirin use, perhaps this needs to be more rigorously studied.
You hit the nail on the head, Elizabeth. It does require additional study. This is a non-randomized retrospective study called a cohort study. It looked at people that used aspirin versus those that didn't. As you noted, it looked like there was less lung cancer in those that used aspirin for 5 years or more, but it was very modest. It was about a 6% decrease. And more specifically, it didn't provide any benefit in those under age 65 and those that had diabetes. It doesn't make sense to me why it shouldn't work for these subgroups. Furthermore, when you looked at it in detail, what you discovered was that the long-term aspirin users actually had higher mortality rates than the non-users in the study. Now, it seemed to, quote, prevent lung cancer modestly, but if you're dying of a higher rate of other reasons, then there's really no particular benefit to low-dose aspirin in this group.
As you know, the ACC, the American College of Cardiology, also recently amended their guidelines with regard to low-dose aspirin use in people for primary prevention with cardiovascular disease. So it's sounding to me like the sum of low-dose aspirin use for disease prevention is headed in a negative direction.
And it depends upon what your risk is of having future cardiovascular disease. Those that have a higher risk are more likely to receive a greater benefit than those that have a lower risk. And because of the risk of GI bleeding and death associated with aspirin use, the benefits have to outweigh the risk. In patients that are at low risk for cardiovascular disease or lung cancer, it may not be beneficial.
And now let us turn back to NEJM.
Our listeners will be aware there's been a lot of focus on selectively preventing or treating amyloid as a way of preventing Alzheimer's disease, because there's a clear association between the deposition of amyloid proteins in the brain and the subsequent development of Alzheimer's disease. Now, this has been approached in several different ways. One is to use anti-amyloid antibodies, and they have been shown to be ineffective in preventing the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Another approach is actually to prevent the formation of amyloid protein. It starts as a precursor, and it goes through two different steps that convert it to the amyloid protein. This is a study that looked at the benefit of using that approach in people that have mild cognitive impairment but clearly don't have Alzheimer's in terms of preventing progression. And why did they choose this group? Because when they looked previously at this approach in people that had mild or moderate Alzheimer's dementia, it didn't prevent progression. So the thought was, well, let's start a little bit earlier. People that have amyloid in their brain, demonstrated by PET imaging, people that have mild cognitive impairment but don't have dementia. So it took 1,500 individuals, randomized them to placebo, or two different doses of this drug, and I'm not going to name it because there were actually two different ones that did the same thing. They were called BACE inhibitors. These are the enzymes that cleave amyloid precursor to the amyloid protein. And what they discovered was even though these inhibitors decreased amyloid protein in the CSF by 60%, and it looked like they decreased amyloid in the brain, they did not prevent progression to Alzheimer's dementia. And in fact, at the higher dose, it actually looked like it increased the progression to Alzheimer's dementia. So this is another disappointing study that suggests that treatment of amyloid protein, at least at this stage in people with cognitive impairment, doesn't prevent Alzheimer's disease.
And lends credence to the idea that we've kicked around many times that amyloid may be a bystander. It may be something that really accumulates but isn't the putative agent when it comes to the development of Alzheimer's disease.
And that's one explanation, certainly. The other is that the accumulation of the amyloid protein can precede overt clinical symptoms by decades. And therefore, by the time we finally do begin to treat it, it's actually too late. So either one of those explanations is true. But what it does tell us is, to be very blunt about it, amyloid protein lowering seems to be an ineffective approach, and it's time to focus on other targets so we can move the treatment of Alzheimer's disease forward and in a different direction.
And for right now, that absolutely, I have to support that conclusion. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.